All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. It's April 8th. Indeed it is, April 8th. And we're going to finish up the sensory chapter today. I got maybe just one more really important slide to show you guys. And then move into endocrine system. But let's look at the schedule first, because our schedule is a little bit different than what I had imagined. So I'll turn some of these lights off. Maybe even that one. I don't know. Leave that one on. All right, so we have two lectures this week, today the 8th, and then on the 10th, and then next week is spring break. The college will be open, the building will be open, but there won't be instructors here. So I know for you anatomy students, at least you can look in the display cases for the anatomical models, but for physiology students, I don't know if there's any good learning resources in the building without instructors. All right, so except for that Friday of spring break, because that's a holiday. And then when we come back from spring break, we have a lecture on the 22nd, and then the third lecture exam on the 24th, Thursday the 24th. And we're scheduled to have 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13. And just looking at things, I don't think there's any way we can cover 13 for the test coming up on the 24th. So the test is going to be 9, 10, 11, and 12. 9, 10, 11, and 12. And I might get some videos on Blackboard for you. I've been working on some of those, and I don't know. I just think you guys are better off if you can ask me questions during lecture or if I give you a lecture. Some of this stuff is a little strange. Like the last couple slides in senses chapter, just things you've never really thought about before, and so I want to present it to you. So I don't want to give up control. Sorry about that. Not that I don't think you guys can learn that on your own or with a video, but some of this stuff is a little strange. Yeah. Yeah, so 13 will be on exam 4. So we'll cover most of that in lecture. Maybe I'll put some of the easier stuff online. All right, because heart, you know a lot about the heart already, and circulation. Like, for instance, how many hearts do you have? You have one heart. Yeah, you have got one organ. But remember, there are really two hearts. What are the two hearts, really? And I just thought of this at the moment. All right, you're right, we have one heart, but there's really two. What are the two hearts? Yeah, they're side by side. There's a right and a left heart, right? So there's actually two hearts that are just kind of glued together. So that tells you how many circulations are there? There are two circulations, so you got to know what the names of those circulations are, right? Systemic and pulmonary circulations. And you're familiar with all the valves already, so you're familiar with a lot of stuff of the heart. I don't feel bad about putting a video online for that kind of stuff. But for instance, coagulation pathways and things like that, I think we need to go over in lecture just a little bit. So for those of you that are just coming in, make sure you get some notes from your friends, and on the 24th, the test is going to cover chapters 9, 10, 11, and 12, not 13. Okay, so that's the deal with that. Anybody have any questions? Yes, a question. Yeah? Oh, I'm sorry? Oh, you know what? Maybe I didn't put them online yet. I bet I have them right here. The audio recordings? The video. You know, this is just such weird stuff. I want to go over it in class. Okay. I didn't put one on. Okay. So, any other questions? And so now I'm going to show you why this is weird. All right. So we're going to finish up sensory chapter. So make sure you know the difference between a general sensation and a special sensation. That's pretty easy. And vision is what kind of sensation? It's special, that's right, because you only have two areas where you have receptors for light. Okay. Oh, was there a question back there? Question? Yeah, oh yeah, question. Oh yeah, I will. You might have to send me an email to remind me. Yeah. Okay. I think I got most of the lab grades. Yeah. Yeah, and then you'll be able to see what your overall score is in class. Oh.
Yeah, I got to get that from your lab instructor, because your lab instructor grades extra credit too, assignments. Okay. Yep, so I'll get that in there. All right, pointer options. All right.
All right, so we were talking about vision when we bailed out of class last time. And you know that the photoreceptors are in a certain layer of the eye. What layer of the eye contains receptors, photoreceptors? It's the retina. Yeah, it's the deepest of the three layers. It's the most delicate, most easily damaged. And how many types of photoreceptors do you have by their shape? Just by their shape. Yeah, you got two. And you know them to be rods and cones. And so you should have some kind of familiarity with what those are good for. And that is, let's start with the rod cells. What good are rod cells for us? Okay, rod cells, let me see. I want to move forward here. Backwards. This is probably a pretty good picture. Notice that the rod cells are a lot bigger and they're a lot wider compared to the cone cells. All right, so that should give you a hint about the difference in their function. Forget about the different color schemes. That doesn't really matter so much. And what are rod cells good for? Black and white vision, not for color. They just don't have any kind of biochemistry in them that can detect differences in color or differences in electromagnetic energy. Color is just a different wavelength, has a little bit different energy associated with it. So rod cells are only for gray vision, right? Grayscale, black, white, and shades in between. Which means then cone cells are for color vision, okay? And then you notice that cone cells are a lot smaller. So they receive light from just a much smaller area. And so the cone cell gives you much better resolution, fine detail, because they're a smaller cell. Right? And the rod cells pick up light from a much bigger area, so they can't give you high resolution images. And they can't give you color. So you might be wondering, what good is a rod cell if you can't see color and you can only see large objects? You don't have fine resolution with a rod cell. What's the advantage of a rod cell? Because it's big, you can see in dim light. Right? So rod cells are really good for dim light. And in order for cone cells to work, in order for you to have sharp vision and color vision, you need to have bright light. All right? So that's the big difference. The other difference is where they're located in the retina. So we move our eyeballs around without turning our head. How can we move our eyeballs around? What moves our eyeballs around? You got muscles, yeah. What kind of muscles are in there? Like those extrinsic eye muscles. Is this coming back to you a little bit? Extrinsic eye muscles. Like you have four rectus, two oblique, right? And those muscles then turn your eyeball so light goes through the cornea and the lens and falls on a specific spot on the retina. Can you remember what that specific spot is? So if there's light coming from over here, because there's an object over here, right? That light comes in and is going to go way off to the side of my eye. But if I turn my eye like that, now that light is coming in and falling right on the best part of the retina. And what is that best part? Yeah, the fovea centralis, which is right smack in the center of the macula lutea. And that fovea centralis has 100% cone cells. So that gives you what? The best detail, best color. But what else has to be with that light? What's another characteristic of that light? It has to be, how about dim? Will it work in dim light? It will not. It has to be bright light, right? So macula lutea, fovea centralis only work in bright light. Yeah.
I'm going to take this. Is this the student that walked out?
Yeah.
She's got to go to the health center.
Oh, my.
Julie's with her right now.
Okay. Thanks, Julie.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I'm having a hard time.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for your help. Okay. So tell her we all hope she's okay soon.
Okay.
Okay, so macula lutea, especially if fovea centralis has 100% cone cells, that's your best vision, and you have those extrinsic eye muscles so that light comes in and falls right on that area. All right, so those are the two kinds of cells. So you might wonder, well, where are the rod cells? Rod cells are in your periphery, on the peripheral aspects of the retina, And that's where you have black and white vision and very low detail, but they work in dim light. So in your peripheral vision, you can't see colors. I don't know if you can tell colors or not in your peripheral vision, but it works in dim light. That's the advantage. Okay. And there's not like a line of demarcation that separates these two different regions. It's just that as you move from the macula lutea to the periphery, then you have less and less cone cells, and you have more and more rod cells. There's not like a line that separates these things, like between the thoracic cavity and abdominal cavity. Okay. All right, so, and the other strange thing, when I first started looking at the eye, was the arrangement of where you find these photoreceptor cells. And they're deep within the retina, so light has to pass through, all right, the lot of layers of nerve cells before it gets to the photoreceptor cells. And I would have thought that these photoreceptor cells would have been right up here superficially in the retina, so light would hit them first, but actually light has to pass by the optic nerve cells, the ganglion cells, amacrine cells, bipolar cells, horizontal cells before it gets to the rod and cone cells. So it has to do, it has to traverse a lot of tissue before it even gets to the rod and cone cells. All right, so we were talking about this slide last time, and we're going to focus just on the rod cells, which is for black and white vision. And the cones are for color, and there's different kinds of cones because basically you can see three different kinds of colors in your eye, and then you can tell more colors from that by the combination of what colors you see. Just like you can hear, like you can taste different things only with five different taste sensations depending on the composition of each of those separate components. All right, so for rod cells, there is a chemical called rhodopsin, and here we see rhodopsin, and one part of rhodopsin is a retinol organic molecule. The other is a protein that we call opsin, and it looks kind of globular, and there's an active site on a piece of opsin, and it's curvilinear. That means that the active site is curved. So what kind of ligand will bind to this curved site on opsin, on the opsin molecule, if it has this curvature to it? Could it be a triangle? Could it be a circle? No, it has to be complementary, right? So the molecule has to be curved in order to fit into that active site. And it just so happens that retinol is one of the compounds that has the proper shape that can bind to opsin, and when it does, then we call it what? Rhodopsin. And it just so happens that retinol can take on two different conformations or two different kinds of shapes. And this is what I wasn't able to point out to you last time, but I see it now. If we look at these methyl groups on the backbone of that hydrocarbon chain, right, we see that in the trans configuration, all the methyl groups are what? Above the hydrocarbon chain. We call this a trans configuration. And if we see on this, the top retinol molecule, we have two methyl groups that are above and one methyl group below. All right, so this changes the shape, and this bond right here can't turn around at all, so this is a nice stable bond. So once this molecule is pretty much locked in this shape, it can't change shape very easily. It's going to take some energy to do that. And what the heck is the energy that can change retinol from a cis configuration to a trans configuration, or from trans to a cis configuration? It is, what do we got right here? We have light energy. All right, so this molecule can absorb light energy and cause a conformation change. Which one of these, the trans or the cis, can bind with opsin? That's only the cis, right? And when it absorbs light, then it comes into this more linear form, can no longer fit into this binding site on opsin, and it probably even dissociates from opsin. Okay, and we're going to see what happens inside the cell. We call that the bleaching reaction, and it takes a little time, right, for these molecules to change conformation again and bind with opsin, and sometimes that's what produces after images when we look at something very bright. Right, because of this bleaching reaction. All right, so then when we're in this all trans configuration, that changes the permeability of the
electric properties of the rod cells, and that eventually produces action potentials in the ganglion cells. And that sends then action potentials to the brain. So how on earth can this conformation change the permeability of the membrane to ions? Well, when you change the permeability of the membrane to ions, what happens? So you got a cell, and you got ions on either side of the membrane, and then you change the permeability in that membrane to various ions. What's going to happen to a property of that membrane? Well, where are you always going to start? You're going to start at resting membrane potential, right? At resting membrane potential. And if you change the permeability of that membrane to some ions, then that resting membrane potential is going to change, right? So it's going to change the potential across the membrane, or the voltage across the membrane. All right, so let's think of a usual kind of scenario. You have a receptor, and when it perceives a stimulus, right, that's going to initiate or excite action potentials. So when that receptor cell receives a stimulus, how does it become excited? What do we usually think of as excitation in terms of movement of ions across the cell membrane? What is usually excitatory? Yeah, sodium goes in. So a sodium channel opens up when a stimulus is applied that drives the membrane closer to threshold, right? And then that produces an action potential. Well, photoreceptors work pretty much the opposite of that. So this is really strange. In dark, the photoreceptors are releasing a neurotransmitter. So in the dark is when these cells are depolarizing. Then light, right, hyperpolarizes, and it stops releasing neurotransmitter in the light. So in the presence of the stimulus, the cell hyperpolarizes. In the absence of stimulus, these cells depolarize, which is kind of strange. Absolutely the opposite thing that we were talking about before. All right, so this depolarizing current we call the dark current. When sodium goes into the cell, when there is no light, then the cell does what? It depolarizes. When the cell has light shining on it, then the sodium channels close, and as a result, the cell becomes hyperpolarized. So light hyperpolarizes these cells by closing sodium channels. So we got to look at some figures to see how this happens. We got two more figures to look at right here. There is an important compound. You've heard of like cyclic AMP. Where does cyclic AMP come from? Cyclic AMP comes from ATP, right? And cyclic AMP only has one phosphorus, not three. And can you remember the name of the enzyme that can convert an ATP to a cyclic AMP? Probably should know, look that up. It is called adenylate cyclase. Adenylate cyclase can make a cyclic AMP. And your body can break cyclic AMP down into just regular old AMP. And you should know the name of the enzyme that converts cyclic AMP into regular old AMP without that ring structure. And that is, we looked at this before, that's a phosphodiesterase. So adenylate cyclase can make cyclic AMP, phosphodiesterase can get rid of it. All right, so how would you talk about the actions of adenylate cyclase and a phosphodiesterase? I'll give you a hint. Yeah, they're antagonistic to each other. And is that weird and bizarre to you? That should not be, right? Because that antagonism provides for precise control and balance. All right, so the visual system works on that same principle. So here we have a part of a rod cell, and we see the rhodopsin molecule, and bound to the rhodopsin molecule, we have a cis-retinol molecule. And associated with this retinol is a G protein. You're familiar with G proteins. So this is just a disc with retinol and these G proteens. And this is in the dark. In the dark, the phosphodiesterase is inactive, right? And what's the job of phosphodiesterase? It breaks down cyclic AMP or cyclic GMP. They're very similar kinds of compounds. So when phosphodiesterase is inactive, cyclic GMP can build up inside the rod cell. And when cyclic GMP is high within the rod cell, it can bind to, what does this look like here? It's a sodium channel, right? And it's a ligand-gated sodium channel, but the ligand binds to the inside part of the channel, not the outside part. Right? So here's that ligand on the inside, and that is cyclic GMP. When it binds, it causes the sodium channel to open up, and what happens to sodium? Of course, it rushes inside the cell because of the electrochemical gradient, right? It's both pointing into the cell. All right, so here's a ligand-gated channel, but it's triggered by cyclic GMP. And this happens in the dark because there's plenty of cyclic GMP inside the cell because this phosphodiesterase is inhibited in the dark. So in the dark, what's happening to the cell? What do we call it when sodium goes in? That is depolarization, right? So that is excitatory on this rod cell right here. All right, so let's now look, let's shine some light on the cell. So we shine some light on the cell, and now we have all trans retinol that activates this G protein, right? And the alpha dissociates from the beta and gamma. This alpha subunit can go over here and bind to a phosphodiesterase, and when it binds, it causes a conformation change of this phosphodiesterase. And what's the job of a phosphodiesterase? It breaks down cyclic AMP or cyclic GMP, so it starts breaking down cyclic GMP. And so now we don't have a cyclic GMP to bind to this ligand-gated channel, and when it comes off and degraded by phosphodiesterase, what happens to this sodium channel? You can see it closes. So in the dark, we see that this cell is depolarizing or is excited. In the light, right, the cell is hyperpolarized because it's no longer depolarizing. Right, so in the presence of a stimulus, these rod cells hyperpolarize, they don't depolarize, which is really the opposite thing that you would ever expect in a receptor cell. All right, so this current of sodium entering the cell and depolarizing the cell in the dark is what we call the dark current, which is exciting the cell all the time. All right, so how on earth does this work? Why is it that the stimulus inhibits the cell, but without stimulus, that is excitatory on this rod cell? Well, we need to look at one more slide, and this is it. This might be an exam figure. Right, but for sure this one is. All right, so we got two conditions when we look at this slide. We've got the dark condition and we have the light condition, right? So light is the stimulus. Let's start with the dark first. All right, so in the dark we said, what happens to this rod cell? Does it depolarize or just stay at RMP or hyperpolarize, or what is it doing? It's depolarizing because there's a cyclic GMP bound to this ligand-gated channel. Sodium is entering the cell, it is depolarizing, and when it depolarizes, it causes release of neurotransmitter. So there is neurotransmitter being released by this rod cell, and there are receptors on this bipolar cell. It just so happens that the neurotransmitter that's being released, right, is inhibitory. So it's an inhibitory neurotransmitter. What's the effect on the bipolar cell? Is it producing EPSPs or IPSPs? On the cell. It's producing IPSPs, which is what? It inhibits the cell. So in the absence of light, even though the rod cell is depolarizing, right, the bipolar cell is hyperpolarizing. And when the bipolar cell hyperpolarizes, can it release neurotransmitter? It does not, because it is inhibited. Right? And then the ganglion cell can't generate any action potentials because it's not receiving a signal from the bipolar cell. So this is the scenario that is happening in the dark. All right, let's turn on the light. What happens? Everybody starts screaming. What happens? Well, you got that G protein dissociating, and the alpha subunit then activates a phosphodiesterase, and when that phosphodiesterase is activated by light, what happens to this cyclic GMP? It breaks down, right? So cyclic GMP breaks down into regular old GMP. That can't fit into the ligand-gated sodium channel, so the sodium channel closes. What happens to the rod cell when that happens? The dark current stops. It no longer depolarizes. It hyperpolarizes. And what do you think of hyperpolarization? Is that excitatory or inhibitory? Yeah, it's inhibitory. So now the rod cell is inhibited. When it's inhibited, does it release neurotransmitter? It cannot, right? So it doesn't release this neurotransmitter, but don't forget, this is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So now the bipolar cell depolarizes. When it depolarizes, it releases a excitatory neurotransmitter on the ganglion cell. So now this neurotransmitter opens up sodium channels on the ganglion cell, which is excitatory on the ganglion cell, drives it to threshold, and the ganglion cell then sends action potentials to the brain, what, in the presence or absence of light? Okay, when does this happen? In the presence of light. Okay, so in the presence of light, the rod cell is inhibited, but that results in excitation of the ganglion cell. In the dark, because of this dark current right here, the rod cell is excited, but the ganglion cell is not, because of what? This inhibitory neurotransmitter. All right, and you know some inhibitory neurotransmitters. Can you remember an inhibitory neurotransmitter? GABA, for instance. Yeah, and excitatory, sometimes acetylcholine is a really good example of an excitatory neurotransmitter. And if it's a nicotinic-type receptor, then acetylcholine is always excitatory, always is going to open up a sodium channel. All right, so this is a little strange, so I'm sure you're going to have to look at this slide once again and just follow these two different tracks. But remember, there's only two circumstances, in the dark and in the light. And in the dark, you have that sodium current, which releases inhibitory neurotransmitter on the rest of the visual system. Right, and in the light, then that inhibition is reduced, and now you have action potentials being sent to the brain when the stimulus is there. Okay. And this is only for the rod cells. All right, so maybe you have to draw this out a couple times before you can just label it by memory. Oh, the potassium channels, in these cells, we can consider them open all the time, all right? And so that is hyperpolarizing the cell, but in the dark, the primary thing that is operating is the sodium channel, so it has more of a tendency to depolarize. When that sodium channel closes, okay, and this potassium channel is still open, that's what hyperpolarizes the rod cell, and when this rod cell is hyperpolarized, it doesn't release the neurotransmitter. Right, so these potassium channels are pretty much open all the time, causing some hyperpolarization. It's overcome in the dark with this ligand-gated sodium channel. The ligand is cyclic GMP. It's a little bit of a mind twister, but once you follow it through, you should be able to see how that goes. Okay, plus there's a pretty good description in the textbook. All right, so if anybody came in late, all right, the test, which is, when is the test going to be? April 24th, right after spring break, a Thursday, but it's only going to be on chapters 9, 10, 11, and 12, not 13, right, for those of you that just came in. Okay, I see who is tardy today up there. Okay, that's okay. I'm sorry, I should put it on dual screen just like that. Any questions on the sensory chapter? Any questions on sensory chapter? Okay, I got one last thing to think about. So this ganglion cell is sending action potentials, and if this ganglion cell is wired up to the temporal lobe, okay, and it's going to send action potentials to the temporal lobe, then when light is shined in your eyes, what is going to be your experience? When action potentials go to the temporal lobe, like right about here, what would you experience? Well, the primary auditory cortex is in the temporal lobe, so when light is shined on your eyes, you will experience some kind of sound event, right? Because this eyeball right here doesn't know that it's light or sound or pressure or vibration. What determines what your experience is? What is receiving these action potentials on the surface of the brain, right? So where do these action potentials go from this ganglion cell in order for you to have a visual experience? They have to go to the, occipital lobe. Now remember, the frontal lobe is primarily there for what reason? Is it afferent or efferent? It initiates motor activity, right? So it's motor, not sensory. Parietal lobe, temporal lobe, occipital lobe are the sensory lobes. The frontal lobe is motor. Because where do you have the motor in your car? In the front, right? Does anybody have a motor right in the middle of their car? I think I asked you this before. Anybody have a car with a motor right in the middle of your car? No? Ah, that's too bad. Okay, we can't be friends then. But if you did, we could be friends very easily. All right, so that's it for a sensory chapter. No more questions on that. So we're going to move to endocrine. And endocrine is going to be similar to the nervous system. So can you think of any important functions of the nervous system? What does the nervous system do? It controls different parts of your body that are separated from each other by a long distance, right? So for instance, if you want to move one of your fingers, one of your digits, it needs to get action potentials from your brain, and you should know what part of the brain those are coming from. What stimulates those action potentials in your brain that move your digits? Where is that located? We just talked about it. What lobe? Let's just start with the lobe. Frontal lobe, okay, and what part of the frontal lobe? And I know you guys know this because you all passed anatomy, right? Might have been a little while ago, but you did pass anatomy. It is what? The precentral gyrus. That's the primary motor cortex, right? So I'm sure it's coming back to you. All right, so that's the job of the nervous system, right? To coordinate and control different parts of your body that are separated from each other. And would you say that that premotor cortex or precentral gyrus, when it controls the finger, is there a long delay? Or is it fast? It's fast. Okay, now what about the duration of action? Okay, yeah, it's for a short period of time. Duration is for a short period of time. So it's nervous system is fast acting, but for a short duration. The endocrine system, on the other hand, it sends signaling compounds all around in your body, but it takes a while for those signaling compounds to get around, and once they bind to a receptor, then it takes a little while to produce a response. So the onset is a lot slower, but what about the duration of action? Unlike the nervous system, now the duration of action is long. All right, so endocrine system and the nervous system are complementary because they have sort of different ways that they operate. One is fast, but for a short duration. The other is slow in happening, but will last for a long period of time. All right, so you're interested in the endocrine system. Well, you got to know what an endocrine gland is. What's an endocrine gland, and how would you contrast that with another kind of gland? Exocrine gland. What's a good way to think about the difference? Whether it has ducts or not, right? So an endocrine gland does not need a duct to transport its signaling compound around, but a exocrine gland has a duct, right, that carries its product from that gland to wherever it's going to have an action. All right, so an endocrine gland secretes a signaling compound directly into the blood, and blood carries it everywhere, so it does not need a duct because the whole vascular system is acting like a duct. All right, and an endocrine gland secretes something that we call a hormone. That's the product. So that hormone gets absorbed in the blood, goes everywhere, and that hormone can, how does that hormone get into the blood? What kind of blood vessel will allow that hormone to get into the blood? Only a capillary, right? Because capillaries are thin. So maybe go back, look at your anatomy book, and then that hormone at some distant location can leave the blood. How can it, what kind of vessel can that hormone leave the blood? Can it be an artery? Can it be an arteriole? Can it be a vein, a venule, or a capillary? Only capillary. Things can enter and leave the blood only through capillaries. That's it. All the other blood vessels are way too thick to allow for exchange. So what does that tell you? What's the function of a capillary? Exchange. Yeah, we're going to look at that. Okay. So what the heck is a hormone? Hormone is a chemical that is secreted by an endocrine cell, which enters the blood, travels to a distant site, and it binds to a receptor, right? In order for that distant site to be able to recognize that hormone, it has to have a receptor for it. and it binds to the receptor, and when the hormone binds to a receptor, it's got to change the physiology of that cell. So that's what a hormone is. It has to change the physiology of that cell, and we like to think of that cell in a certain way. How would we talk about that cell if it has a receptor for a particular hormone? It is a, right here, can I highlight it? No, I can't. Whoa, sorry. It is a target cell or a target tissue, right? And what makes a target tissue or a target cell different from any other kind of tissue in your body? It's got to have a receptor, right? Has no receptor, then it's completely insensible to that particular hormone. Okay, so hormones come from endocrine glands, and here is a slide that shows some endocrine glands, and there are some signaling compounds that enter the blood that are secreted by neurons, for instance, of the hypothalamus and of the posterior pituitary. You remember the posterior pituitary is neuronal in origin. It's not a gland per se like the anterior pituitary. So here are neurons that are secreting compounds that get picked up by the blood that travel to a distant location and bind to a receptor producing a specific response. All right, so what do we want to call these things that are secreted by these neurons? Do we want to call these a hormone? A hormone isn't secreted by a neuron. It's secreted by what? An endocrine gland. So these signaling compounds are what we call neurohormones. And here is another example of that interface between the nervous system and the endocrine system. And we saw that before in terms of the autonomic nervous system. Where was that interface located before when we looked at autonomic nervous system? The adrenal medulla, right? So there is a preganglionic neuron going to the adrenal medulla. The cells of the adrenal medulla act like the postganglionic cell. They release epinephrine and norepinephrine into the blood. So they're really like neurons, but they secrete their product into the blood. So those adrenal medulla cells are acting like an endocrine gland as well. So epinephrine, norepinephrine in that case would be neurohormones. All right, so a target cell has their metabolism adjusted. That's the whole job of a hormone. So where do we have some endocrine glands? You're familiar with some of them, like a testes and an ovary. Anybody have an idea what kind of hormone an ovary secretes? Probably you do. Like estrogen, progesterone, right? Testes right here, testosterone. What about, you know anything about the pituitary? What kind of hormones it secretes? Yeah, like human growth hormone. That should be some good ones. Some hormones that affect the gonads, whether it's an ovary or testes right here, like follicle-stimulating hormone, luteinizing hormone, things like that. We're going to look at some of these. You might have heard of some of these different kind of hormones. Thyroid is an endocrine gland. It secretes thyroid hormone. Another name for that is thyroxine. Adrenal gland. In the adrenal cortex, in particular, there are some hormones. There are things that adjust glucose. There are other hormones that adjust sodium and potassium. And so sometimes we call those glucocorticoids, and sometimes we call them mineralocorticoids, depending on whether they're affecting glucose metabolism or sodium and potassium metabolism. Another one, pancreas, right over here. You're probably really familiar with the pancreas. It secretes hormones, and do you know the name of any that are coming from the pancreas? Insulin in particular. Yeah, that's right. So maybe if somebody gets a viral infection of the pancreas and it kills those cells that secrete insulin, then what happens to that person? They become a person with diabetes mellitus, right? They can't regulate blood glucose. All right, so here are a bunch of endocrine glands, but you have many, many more endocrine glands. Your kidney is an endocrine gland. Not shown on this diagram, your heart is an endocrine gland. And we're going to talk about some of these other things that are not so obvious, okay, in your training so far. So here is a list. It's fairly comprehensive of a number of endocrine glands. Adipose tissue, adrenal cortex we just talked about, adrenal medulla you're aware of. The heart, I said, is an endocrine gland. Indeed it is. Right, small intestine, pancreas, kidneys, liver, ovaries,
What else is kind of strange? Stomach is an endocrine gland. Skin is an endocrine gland because they secrete, what do they secrete? Hormones. Yeah, directly into the blood. And those hormones travel to a distant location, bind to a receptor, and it produces a specific response inside that target cell. Okay, well, we're going to talk about some of these hormones, but I want to mention a couple pairs of these hormones. All right, I see insulin and glucagon right here from the pancreas. And when I see insulin and glucagon, I immediately think of triceps brachii and biceps brachii. Or sometimes I think of parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. So what's the relationship between insulin and glucagon that I'm just kind of beating around the bush with? They're antagonistic to each other, right? So if you have antagonistic nervous systems like sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, you should not be shocked that the endocrine system has antagonistic hormones as well. All right, and so you can read up over here, but insulin decreases blood glucose concentration, but glucagon does the opposite, it increases. Right, and remember that antagonism is very important for things that need precise control and balance like blood glucose concentration. Then it's best to have two pathways that are antagonistic to each other. All right, what else? Aldosterone from the adrenal cortex. One of the effects of aldosterone is that it promotes sodium retention. Your body will retain sodium as a result of release of aldosterone. And let's look at the heart. Where do you find the heart? Natriuretic hormone, right, has the opposite effect of aldosterone, which is what? It promotes excretion of sodium. So what can you tell me about aldosterone and atrial natriuretic hormone? Oh, here. They are antagonistic to each other. And I don't see anybody gasping, right, because you would expect that kind of precise control. So that's the second example. Third example. There's another, well, there is a mineral. We did talk about sodium, and that's, of course, a mineral. There's another mineral that's very important. If you're going to pick another mineral that's really important in your body, what would you think of? What would you pick? Okay. I would be thinking about potassium, but really what I was thinking about, and somebody mentioned it just now, is calcium, right? That's a mineral. And, of course, what do you need calcium for? Strong bones, but what else? Muscle contraction, and you also need it for taking a signal across the synapse. So synaptic transmission, you need proper levels of calcium, and that has to be maintained in the blood. So a good antagonistic mechanism comes from two hormones, parathyroid hormone, okay, which increases the concentration of calcium in the blood. And one way that happens is that it helps break down bone. What kind of cell do you know breaks down bone? Osteoblast, right? So parathyroid hormone stimulates osteoblastic activity, but you don't want your bones to dissolve, so there should be another hormone that decreases blood calcium by putting calcium into bones, stimulating It's not the blast that breaks down bone, it is the clast. Come on, class. That's good you know that. Okay. Osteoclast breaks down bone, the blast builds bone back up, and the hormone, and the end of the table here is kind of screwy because of the way things kind of wrap around in the columns. The hormone that I'm talking about is calcitonin, all right, and calcitonin decreases blood calcium level. So again, they're going to be antagonistic. Parathyroid hormone and calcitonin are antagonistic to each other. But sometimes we can't get really good agreement in the scientific community that calcitonin is important in humans. It's certainly important in many other kinds of animals, so we just suspect that it has the same effect in humans as well to some degree. All right, so that's all I wanted to point out right now on this table. When you look at this table, do you find antagonism? Yeah, and you don't have to look very far. And maybe on the tip of your tongue you should have those three examples or six hormones. All right, so let's talk about some classification of hormones. One of the easiest classifications, we can break them down into two kinds. One kind that like to dissolve in water, and what's the other kind then? The kind that hate water, right? So hydrophilic, hydrophobic kinds of hormones, they're going to have quite a bit different action in your body.
All right, so amine hormones are derived from tyrosine or tryptophan. What are these guys? Tyrosine and tryptophan are amino acids. All right, and so, I did mention this before, so norepinephrine, epinephrine, thyroxine from the thyroid gland, melatonin, right, are derived, are amine hormones derived from tyrosine and tryptophan. If you don't have these things in your diet, they're essential amino acids. That means you can't make these hormones, right? And which means then you can't maintain homeostasis when these hormones are involved. We have some polypeptide or protein hormones. And so these are not just a single amino acid. These are what? Chains of amino acids that are bound together with peptide bonds. If you're familiar with that, some good examples would be antidiuretic hormone. And another name, write this down on your slide. Another name for antidiuretic hormone is called vasopressin. Vasopressin is a polypeptide. I need to go back. Where do we have antidiuretic hormone? Where is that coming from? Let's look for a pituitary gland. Do we have a pituitary anywhere in here? Way down, pituitary gland. Ah, pituitary gland. Antidiuretic hormone, posterior pituitary. On this table, what do you want to write in right next to antidiuretic hormone? It's vasopressin. Vasopressin, just one word. And that's because antidiuretic hormone does a couple things. What does a diuretic do? A diuretic makes you pee. What does an antidiuretic do? Makes you retain water, right? So that's really what we think of the action of antidiuretic hormone. But it also has another effect, which we see over here. It causes vasoconstriction. And vasoconstriction, take a water balloon and constrict it, squeeze that water balloon down, okay, or maybe it just has air in the balloon. What happens to the pressure when you squeeze on that balloon? What happens to the pressure inside the balloon? It goes up, 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 up when you change, when you make the volume smaller. And if you squeeze so much and increase the pressure so much, what's eventually going to happen to that balloon? It's going to burst because of that high pressure. Right, so antidiuretic hormone or vasopressin causes vasoconstriction, which does what to your blood pressure? Yeah, it makes it higher. So that's how it got its other name. Vasopressin means that it increases your blood pressure. Okay, so that's a polypeptide hormone. Growth hormone, insulin, oxytocin, glucagon, all these other hormones are proteins. Insulin is a fairly short polypeptide. And I think some bacteria have been taught how to make insulin, because otherwise we'd have to grind up pancreases to get it. But through genetic engineering techniques, the gene from insulin was isolated and then inserted into the genome of a bacteria, actually probably just a plasmid, and then that plasmid was introduced into bacteria. And what do these bacteria do all day long? They make insulin for us in a test tube. So that's really nice, right? And what is that process where insulin is produced? What's the name of that process that makes a polypeptide? Do you all know? Called protein synthesis, right? And what are the two stages of protein synthesis you have? First, transcription, and then translation, right? Okay, because we're going to talk about some of that stuff later on in this chapter. We got some glycoproteins. All I want you to know about glycoproteins is that it's part sugar and part protein, right, that have been conjugated. What kind of organelle inside your cells modifies proteins and packages of them into vesicles? Like a Golgi apparatus, yeah. Some are steroids. Steroids are a lot different than these other hormones because they're lipids, and most of these are derived from cholesterol, so you should probably have a picture in your mind what the general shape of cholesterol is. Then you have a general idea of what testosterone looks like, and estrogen and progesterone, cortisol, right? And are steroids lipophilic or lipophobic? They're lipophilic, okay? They're lipophilic, which means they are hydrophobic. Yeah, they're hydrophobic, okay? So these steroids, since they're hydrophobic, can they move across the cell membrane? Because they like lipid. Yeah, they can. They can dissolve right through the cell membrane. They can get inside the cell. What about these other hydrophilic hormones? Can they get it through the cell membrane? They cannot, right? Okay, so the receptors for these above here have to be outside the cell, but receptors for steroids are inside the cell. And they're going to have different kinds of options. Oh, here are the shapes of things that we were just talking about. Here's cholesterol, that base molecule, can be modified just a little bit, right, to make pregnenolone. I don't think it's really important that you know these pathways in particular, but you should know that progesterone comes from cholesterol, right, that androgens come from progesterone, which come from cholesterol, and estrogens come from testosterone, which comes from cholesterol. So all of these molecules are related with some very simple kinds of chemical modifications. Okay. And cortisol is a glucocorticoid. And so this helps regulate glucose metabolism inside our cells. All right. So here we have one of the endocrine glands that we're going to look at. And this right here is thyroxine. Thyroxine comes from the thyroid gland, and you can see it has a couple of ring structures. And bound to these ring structures are some iodine. And in order for this hormone to have any potency in your body, these iodine molecules have to be there. And so how many iodines do you see in thyroxine? I see four, right? So sometimes we call this tetraiodothreonine or just T4. T4 and thyroxine are really the same thing, and they have these four iodines. Now, can you make iodine in your body? You cannot, because it's an element. You can't make chemical elements. You can't do nuclear physics inside your body. So where do you get this iodine from? Yeah, it has to be in your diet. And if you don't have iodine in your diet, then you can't make this hormone, and that produces some very strange effects, right? That produces pathology in our body. We're going to look at some of that. There is a related compound, and this is triiodothreonine. So how many iodines does it have? It only has three. And this is the active form of thyroid hormone. All right, so T3 is really the active form. Okay. Wow, I don't know. Was that in your list right there? Or was that later? It seems to be a little misplaced for me when I'm looking at this. Okay. I still want to make some general comments about the endocrine system. So remember, nervous system and endocrine system connect different parts of your body together. Right, the difference is neurotransmitters are released via rapid kinds of systems, like through nerve impulses. Hormones take a while to get from one place to another because it's got to go through the circulatory system. The targets for both neurotransmitters and hormones have to have a receptor. And when a neurotransmitter or hormone binds to a receptor, that produces a specific change in that target cell. So that's pretty important. A tissue can have a number of different receptors, so it can respond to a number of different kinds of hormones. Right? And if two hormones work together to produce an effect, we say they are synergistic. And that also means that if two hormones are synergistic, then the effect of both of them added together is greater than the effect than if one was used and then the other, and then the two responses were added together. It's not just a simple addition of two responses, right? So if they're synergistic, the effect is larger when they are working together. As opposed to if we were just add the two responses singly together. A hormone has a permissive effect if it enhances the responsiveness of a target tissue to a second hormone, or even allows that second hormone to have an effect. Without a first hormone, sometimes a second hormone won't have an effect, right? But if the first hormone is there, that allows the second hormone to have an effect in the body. So there's a receptor that has to bind two hormones, not just one. And when that happens, we call that a permissive effect. And of course, not only do we have synergistic, but we also have antagonistic hormones, and we talked about that when we looked at that table, right? So you should know what is your favorite pair of hormones that are antagonistic to each other, that you're really familiar with? Insulin and glucagon. Right, probably even before you took this class. All right, so how do these hormones, how do they work? So we're going to have to look at some of the molecular aspect. Well, a target cell has to have receptors, and just like for enzymes, they got to show specificity, they can be saturated, right? And there's a high affinity for a hormone to its particular receptor because the shapes just match up so perfectly. So that means then, since there's high affinity, then you don't need a lot of hormone to produce a response. So we say that is low capacity because there is high affinity. Some hormones are hydrophobic, which means they're lipophilic. Means then that those hormones can move across the cell membrane. They have to have receptors inside the cell, or they can have receptors inside the cell. And usually for these receptors that are inside the cell, they're going to affect transcription. So lipophilic hormones usually affect transcription. And what do you know about transcription? It's a part of what? Part of protein synthesis, right? It's the first part of protein synthesis. So these lipophilic hormones produce their response by building different kinds of proteins inside the cell. Right, and you know something about proteins, they could be enzymes, they could be more hormones, for instance. Right, so we call that the genomic action of these, for instance, maybe steroid hormones. And because we're talking about protein synthesis, it takes a long time for these hormones to have an effect. Right, so it could be a half hour, it could be much longer, because after transcription, then what has to happen? In order to make a protein, then you need translation, right? So it's a many-step process in order to change the physiology inside these cells. Receptors for water-soluble hormones have to be on the outside of the membrane, because they can't get inside the cell. And a lot of these receptors are G-protein-coupled receptors that act through second messengers with inside the cell, and some these effects are much quicker than cytoplasmic receptors. Some steroid hormones do have cell surface receptors, and we call this the non-genomic action of these hormones because they don't work through initiating transcription. They're not transcription factors. They have other effects inside the cell. And in this chapter, you're going to be really happy because we're going to talk about some of these specific examples of what these G-protein receptors do in the processes that you're already familiar with a little bit. So we're going to start to apply some of that knowledge. All right, so here we have a hormone, H. And I see it bound to a carrier protein. This is going to be a globulin, a globular kind of protein. And it can dissociate from the carrier protein and be some free hormone inside the blood, right, in plasma. And it can go across the cell membrane. So what kind of hormone is this? Is that hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's got to be a hydrophobic hormone, right? Like, for instance, a steroid, right, is a lipid hormone. And where do you have receptors? Mostly for lipid hormones inside the cell. So here we have a cytoplasmic receptor. The hormone is going to bind to the receptor. So this has two different domains. Here is a hormone binding domain. And this other domain over here can actually bind to a part of a DNA molecule. So here's a hormone domain, here's the DNA domain, and this thing becomes activated when the hormone binds to it in the cytoplasm, then it's translocated into the nucleus, and now it can bind to a DNA molecule, and when that happens, that can activate this gene. What does a gene produce eventually? A protein, right? And so what do we call this step, going from DNA to messenger RNA? What do we call that step? So if we had we should have an arrow right here, DNA to RNA. That is transcription. That's transcription. So this nuclear hormone receptor, when it binds the hormone, acts like what? It initiates transcription. We call that a transcription factor. And so that starts protein synthesis, and then you end up with proteins. These different proteins inside the cell change the physiology inside the cell, which is then the response to this particular hormone. All right, so steroid hormones have these nuclear hormone receptors inside the cell. Why do we have this carrier protein? for a steroid hormone in the blood.
Because steroids are hydrophobic. They don't like to be in water. They need like a detergent molecule that they bind to that allows them to dissolve in water. Right, that's the job of this carrier protein right here. It just allows the steroid hormone to dissolve in water.
Yeah, question. I think I saw a question.
Yeah, but it's a transcription factor when the receptor binds its hormone.
If it doesn't bind a hormone right here, then it can't act as a transcription factor. It doesn't have the right conformation. Okay. So that's why this hormone can change the physiology of the cell, because it can produce different kinds of proteins. That's a very specific response. All right, so we talked about transcription factors. Steroids do this. Thyroid hormone is a lipid type of hormone. It's hydrophobic. And also vitamin D and retinoic acid are lipids. All right, so they can act as transcription factors. So here is that length of DNA, and so here is the gene that can be activated, right, can be transcribed if, right, there's a proper transcription factor available to it. Right, so here is that receptor for steroid hormone. Here is the hormone. Here are the two different domains. Here's the ligand binding domain that we talked about, or the hormone binding domain. Here's the DNA binding domain. When the hormone binds, then the DNA binding part of this receptor can bind to the DNA molecule. But guess what? This area right here needs to have two hormone receptors bound to it. So we call this a hormone response element. Both have to bind a hormone receptor. And so that's what we see down over here. This is a proper configuration where transcription can be initiated. We call this dimerization. So it doesn't require just one hormone, it requires two with the proper receptors. In this particular case, the hormone is going to be the same. I just see H and H. Right? This process of dimerization, if the hormone is exactly the same for each of this, we call this homodimerization. Right, so only one kind of hormone is necessary to act as a transcription factor. All right, so we got the hormone response element on DNA. We got homodimerization, which means probably that in some circumstances you might need two different hormones. We would call that heterodimerization. And we're going to look at an example of that. All right, well, this is where that other slide belongs that we looked at previously. The thyroid hormone, T3 and T4, they come from the thyroid gland. And what's necessary for thyroxine to have proper action inside your body, it has to have iodine, right? Okay. And since these are lipid hormones, they need a carrier protein in order to be transported in the blood, because they don't dissolve all by themselves in the blood. And we call that a thyroid binding globulin, or TGB. And also, since the thyroid gland is a reservoir for T4, there has to be binding globulins inside the thyroid gland, right, in order to make T4 and T3 soluble even within the thyroid gland. All right, remember, T4 is converted into T3 inside the cell, so there has to be a receptor protein that binds T3, and then, of course, that is translocated into the nucleus, and it acts as a transcription factor. So let's look at a heterodimerization scheme. So here we have here's the hormone response element with two binding sites. Right, here are two different receptors, and you can see that it has two different kinds of active sites for two different kinds of hormones. This one right here will bind triiodothreonine, and if that binds to the hormone response element, that will not initiate transcription. What else has to be there? Cisretinoic acid has to bind to a second receptor, right, and it binds to the other half of that hormone response element. And you see that the hormones are different, so we call that heterodimerization. Now that becomes an active transcription factor, which then allows for transcription right? And that produces messenger RNA, which produces other kinds of proteins inside the cell. And so in this particular case, right, this shows what the permissive effect of one hormone on the other. Both of these have to be available to act as a transcription factor. For some hormones, they have to have a second messenger. All right, so what can you tell me about this hormone if it has to have a second messenger? Where are you always going to find this hormone that has a second messenger? Or how should you think of this hormone? If it produces a second messenger, what's the hormone? It's a first messenger. Yeah, it's a first messenger. And where do you find first messengers always? Outside the cell. Right, so these are water-soluble hormones, which we talked about. Water-soluble hormones usually have an effect on the cell because they produce second messengers. Right, and that second messenger then produces the action of what we understand that hormone to be. All right, so what are some second messengers? Oh, I bet this is an exam figure. All right, so here we see a nice cell membrane. Here we see the intracellular compartment. All right, so this is inside the cell. Here's extracellular fluid outside the cell. We have a hormone, and it's binding to a receptor that is extracellular. So tell me something about this hormone right here. What's the physical chemistry properties of this hormone? It is water-soluble, right? Water-soluble means it can't get through the phospholipid bilayer. It has to have an extracellular receptor. And you're familiar with this thing right here because it's coupled to a G protein. When a hormone binds to the receptor, activates or releases the G protein, allows for dissociation, right? Alpha from the beta and gamma subunits. These things can float around, dissolve right on the surface or even on the inside of the membrane because these are hydrophobic kinds of compounds. When an alpha particle of a G protein bumps into this enzyme right here, we call it adenylate cyclase, it activates this enzyme. So remember, an enzyme speeds up the rate of some kind of chemical reaction. And what's the chemical reaction that adenylate cyclase speeds up? The conversion of ATP to cyclic AMP. Okay, and now cyclic AMP becomes the second messenger inside the cell. And we've mentioned that a number of times. Cyclic AMP is the second messenger. What's the first messenger? This hydrophilic hormone. And there are, as you've seen, there's a number of them. All right, that cyclic AMP, right, can bind to some regulatory unit on a protein kinase. Right, and when it binds, it can activate the protein kinase by inactivating this inhibitory subunit. So the inhibitory subunit comes off with cyclic AMP, and now we have an active protein kinase. What does a kinase do inside the cell? It runs around phosphorylating things, changing the shape of other kinds of proteins that could be activating them if they're enzymes or inactivating them, depending on the kind of enzyme. Right, so it can activate enzymes or inactivate enzymes, which do what? It changes the physiology of the cell. Right, so what do we have right here? We've got one enzyme, then we got a second enzyme. What happens to an enzyme when it catalyzes a reaction? Does it get used up? It does not. Right. So when you bind one hormone and that activates adenylate cyclase, that produces more than one cyclic AMP. It could produce thousands of cyclic AMPs before adenylate cyclase is inactivated. So what do we call that? Going from 1 to 1,000. That is a level of amplification, right? You need a very small signaling molecule, just one, to produce thousands of second messengers inside the cell. That's a level of amplification. That cyclic AMP then also activates more enzymes. What happens to protein kinase when it phosphorylates one substrate? Does it get used up? It doesn't get used up, right? Enzymes never do. So this protein kinase can phosphorylate thousands of more, right, enzymes inside the cell. And so that's another level of, you have one cyclic AMP producing, what, many phosphorylated proteins inside the cell. That's another level of amplification. What do we call it when we have a sequence of levels of amplification? We have many steps that are amplifying this one little signal right here. What do we call that? Maybe positive feedback because it's happening really fast. Okay, but what I like to think of it as is a cascade mechanism. I think it's better for you to think of it as a cascade, where you have many levels of amplification, which means you have one first messenger, but many, many, many second messengers inside the cell. All right, so that's really what I want you to see on this slide, that it's a cascade mechanism. And for sure, I want you to know that adenylate cyclase does what? It produces cyclic AMP from ATP. And I want you to know what a protein kinase is. What does a kinase do once again? It phosphorylates something. What's antagonistic to a protein kinase? Would be a protein phosphatase, right? Phosphatase and kinase are antagonistic to each other, right? And then you might be able to figure this one out as well. Adenylate cyclase produces cyclic AMP, but now there has to be an enzyme that breaks down cyclic AMP. We saw that in the sensory chapter. What enzyme breaks down cyclic AMP or cyclic GMP? It is a phosphodiesterase, right? So remember these enzymes in antagonistic pairs. Kinase and phosphatase. Adenylate cyclase and phosphodiesterase, right, are antagonistic to each other. And of course you know that is an excellent good thing to have in your body. Okay, that antagonism. Here is another example of a different kind of second messenger system. And here I have a hormone binding to a receptor. What can you tell me about this hormone right here? It is hydrophilic, right? Hydrophilic means it can't get through the cell membrane. It has to have an extracellular receptor. And this is a G protein coupled receptor. It activates this G protein. Subunits can bump into phospholipase. And in particular, this is probably the third one that somebody noticed at some point in time. So it's phospholipase number 3 or phospholipase C. Doesn't look like a C, probably just the third one that somebody found. And what can you tell me about phospholipase? What's the substrate? What's the substrate for phospholipase? Is a phospholipid, right? Phospholipase. So a lot of times in modern nomenclature, the substrate is used to name this particular enzyme. Now, this is a terrible thing because where are you going to get phospholipids from with phospholipase embedded in the membrane right here? How are we going to get phospholipids to this enzyme, phospholipase C? Seems really complicated. I don't know where I would go to find a phospholipid. You know what? It's surrounded by phospholipids, right? Because it's within the membrane. So here's something interesting, right? That phospholipid bilayer is an important structure, but it also participates in this very important biochemical pathway that produces second messengers inside the cell, right? Just like water is an important part of the solvent, but it participates in many kinds of chemical reactions in our body. You're aware of that, right? And so phospholipase, very handily, is embedded in the cell membrane, which has what? Plenty of substrates because it's made of phospholipids. When phospholipase gets activated, it makes a second messenger that we're going to call IPI3, and that's inositol-3-phosphate. You don't have to know what the structure is, but you have to know what IPI3 does, right? It's in the cytoplasm, right? So what kind of messenger is IPI3? Second messenger, right, produced by phospholipase. When it binds to endoplasmic reticulum, especially the smooth kind of endoplasmic reticulum, that calcium is released into the cytoplasm, right? So one of the jobs of smooth ER is to act as a reservoir for calcium. So you could even think of calcium as being a second messenger, right? So both IPI3 and calcium are second messenger. The first messenger is trapped outside the cell. Yeah, question. G protein, second messenger. You could consider a G protein when it's dissociating a second messenger because you never see it outside the cell. It's always on the inside of the cell. Okay, so you could consider the G-protein, IP3, and calcium all second messengers, because where do you find them always? Inside the cell. And their concentration builds up inside the cell as a result of what? A first messenger binding to a receptor outside the cell. All right, so understanding of a second messenger, sometimes it's a little fuzzy. It's not just one. It could be a combination of things building up inside the cell. Right. It could be cyclic AMP as a second messenger. What kind of enzyme produces cyclic AMP? Adenylate cyclase. Yeah, adenylate cyclase. What produces IP3? Phospholipase C. And the substrates, phospholipase C is surrounded by substrate. Right. So that is pretty fortunate. Oh, another kind of second messenger, diacyl glycerate. And we're just going to call that DAG. Maybe we'll look at a DAG pathway later on in the chapter. So you got cyclic AMP, IP3, and DAG as being second messengers. All right, so now you've got calcium as a second messenger inside the cell. You're familiar with what some of the actions of calcium are. What's the concentration of calcium normally inside the cell in the cytoplasm when the cell's at rest? That's basically zero, right? It's very, very low. And so calcium then rushes into the cytosol, and it can bind to a molecule that we've talked about before, calmodulin, right? So, and calmodulin is a molecule that binds calcium, and it can modulate the activity of other kinds of enzymes inside the cell. That's how it got its name. And calmodulin is only active when it is bound calcium. And of course, that calcium comes from, for instance, like IP3, when it binds to the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. All right, so calmodulin, when it binds calcium, can activate protein kinases. So what do those protein kinases do? They phosphorylate something, change the conformation of other enzymes. Maybe it can activate those enzymes or inactivate them, depending on the conformation change. But nonetheless, that changes the physiology inside the cell when you turn enzymes on and off. You just have to believe me, and I'll show you. Maybe I'll show you right now. Okay. Here we have a liver cell. And liver cell does a lot of important things, but we talked about liver before, and in what sense? What's a liver cell good for? It stores a lot of things. In particular, what are you familiar with? Glycogen. And what's the building block of glycogen? Glucose, right? So when your blood glucose concentration decreases, guess what good the liver is? It can chop glycogen down into glucose, and then it can put that glucose in the blood, maintaining glucose, blood glucose homeostasis, right? So let's look and see how that happens. All right, a liver cell has different kinds of receptors, right? So a cell can have different kinds of receptors. I see here a beta adrenergic receptor, and I also see an alpha adrenergic receptor. And a beta adrenergic receptor is going to bind norepinephrine or epinephrine. And when it does, it activates adenylate cyclase, probably through that G-protein coupled pathway that we saw before. Right? So one of the subunits of a G-protein bumps into adenylate cyclase, and it turns on adenylate cyclase. And what does adenylate cyclase do? It makes a second messenger inside the cell, cyclic AMP. Then that cyclic AMP can activate a protein kinase. And what does a protein kinase do? It phosphorylates something. Let's stop right there for the moment. Let's look at this alpha adrenergic receptor. When it binds epinephrine, then that's going to allow calcium to build up inside the cytosol. We looked at a couple mechanisms of how that is. Calcium then can bind to calmodulin, and it can activate another kind of protein kinase. And what does that protein kinase do? Phosphorylate something. So now we have a couple of protein kinases that are active. And guess what you need to do to glycogen to chop off a glucose molecule? You got to phosphorylate it. And what kind of enzyme would you use to phosphorylate a glucose subunit on a glycogen molecule? What kind of enzyme do you need? You need a kinase, right? And so these activated protein kinases then chop glycogen down into glucose-1-phosphate. Does glucose-1-phosphate have a phosphate on it? Indeed it does, right? And this glucose-1-phosphate, of course, can't get outside the cell because this phosphate is way too polar to move across the cell membrane. So what happens? The liver can rearrange glucose-1-phosphate into glucose-6-phosphate, taking it from the first carbon to the last carbon on that glucose. And then the liver has another enzyme that can make just regular old plain glucose that can leave the cell. What kind of enzyme would you write in right here? What takes a phosphate off of a molecule? A phosphatase, right? And liver cells have phosphatases, but muscle cells don't. Muscle cells never lose glucose, but this liver cell can. All right, so here we see how activation of some protein kinases can change the activity of the cell, like maintaining blood glucose homeostasis, in particular through this liver cell. All right, so beta adrenergic receptors work through cyclic AMP as a second messenger. Alpha adrenergic receptors work through calcium as a second messenger. That's probably a pretty good thing to just remember. Beta for cyclic AMP, alpha for calcium as a second messenger inside the cell. So now you know some really good physiology like blood glucose homeostasis and how that's regulated by these different receptors through G-protein coupled receptors, right, and even calmodulin and other kinds of nifty things. Here is another kind of receptor that I think we're going to start talking about next time. It's a tyrosine kinase. All right, so what does a tyrosine kinase enzyme do? It phosphorylates tyrosine amino acids that are in a big protein someplace, and that's going to change the activity of those proteins. This is the kind of receptor that insulin has to have. Insulin is a tyrosine kinase receptor. And are you guys interested in learning anything about how insulin works and how it's activated in your body? Yeah, you should really be interested in that, right? So we're going to pay particular attention to this slide because if these receptors are not working, that produces a form of diabetes, right? Okay, so we are really interested in this. Even though it might look a little complicated, okay, we're going to learn something about that next time. But this slide here is fun to know about. All right, and then we're going to go to pituitary gland. Any questions? Don't forget, what's on the exam? Ooh, next time. What's on the exam next time? What's on the exam? Oh, I got it right here. Do I have it right here? I do have it right here. 9, 10, 11, and 12, but not 13. 9, 10, 11, and 12, but not 13. Okay, that's it for today.